I wonder how much of the facilitator has to like bring in this cult of personality. Because Matt, it's not just ending the workshop, right? It's saying, okay, now we got to think of, in a different way. And now we're going to take what you did and think in a different way now, you know, because we have like creativity at the start and then causality and puzzle solving in the middle, you know, and then we get all the way to others. So I wonder how much of that is really facilitated by, yeah, embracing a very specific profile of emotional, I don't want to say manipulation, but sometimes it almost feels like that because we have to get through it. Back to you.
Pass. I don't know what to do with that. No, it's great. It's a great observation. I don't know. Just cut this out. I don't know. I don't know. I'm sorry. That's a cult of personality. You got me stuck on that. That's where you got me stuck.
Welcome to Scenarios for Tomorrow, a podcast where we turn tomorrow's headlines into today's thought experiments. This first series includes conversations with the authors of our latest book, Improving and Enhancing Scenario Planning, Futures Thinking Volume, from Edward Elgar Publishing. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Crawford, and throughout this first series, you'll hear from my guests the numerous global techniques for practicing and advancing scenario planning. Enjoy! Today, we are lucky to have two guest authors with us. First is Nicholas Rowland, who is a distinguished professor of sociology at Penn State University in the US. He is also the academic trustee on Penn State's Board of Trustees. Nicholas studies governance, the future, and the conduct of science. Matthew Spaniel is a senior researcher of strategic foresight in the Department of People and Technology at Roskilde University in Denmark. Matt has curated a YouTube channel called the Futures and Foresight Papers Explained, where he has about a dozen or so scholars talking about their papers, of which both Nick and I have both been guests. So I highly recommend checking that out. Links will be provided in the show notes. So, welcome both. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. It's a
Thank
pleasure
you
to
for
be
having
here.
us.
We have had the opportunity, more than many, to catch up at our various international conferences and events that have gone around. But as it happens, I understand that the two of you have known one another for some time. Is that right?
Indeed, that's the case. In fact, scholars that have seen our work, probably don't know that Matt and I actually went to college together so many years ago. And in fact, during our freshman year, we coincidentally lived right across the hall from one another. And so once we graduated, our paths went a slightly different direction. I went directly into a sociology graduate program. But then later on, we kind of got connected. Matt, do you want to take over what you did?
And so I went into finance and banking for a while, and then did a master's in international development in South America, and came back and ended up at the Copenhagen Institute for Future Studies.
All
And
right.
that was one of the, that's basically when we sort of rejoined forces, let's say. And so we've been writing ever since, and that was about 10 years ago.
Do y'all have any idea about how many papers you have together or books?
Papers total? Oh gosh, I don't know. At least a dozen. Probably
Yeah.
pushing 20.
It could be.
Nice. Nice and enviable professional relationship there. We're all looking for that. In fact, our university, our department rather, just had one called Finding Your Research Life Partner, something like that. And I thought about y'all with that one. And I was like, no, but that's cute. So I'm grateful that we could find this time to chat because I know it's really difficult for all of us to get our schedules aligned, especially since we're all teaching. We're at exam times, all this kind of stuff. But I wanted to talk specifically with y'all, not just because you're authors on the book, but because of what you brought to the book. And it has to do with this latest shift in the focus in our field of scenario planning. So, as mentioned in the introduction, we've just published this book together about scenario planning in the 21st century. And we're right here at the quarter century mark in 2025. And we'd like to talk a little bit more about that. We understand that not all of our listeners may be familiar with even the concept or the terms scenario planning, though some may have heard more about us since the pandemic when our field got extremely popular. But one of the motivations to this podcast, as well as was to the book, was to bring our world of futures and foresight science outside the walls of academia, where within, understandably, the language is closely controlled, but knowledge ends up being not as easily to access as we generally wish it to be, which just means we're here to have a chat with the public. Yeah.
Sounds great.
All right. Well, your chapter then is titled Examining Emotion in the Facilitation of Scenario Planning. Now, with that, let's start with a little softball question, right? So, what is, in your professional experiences, what is scenario planning?
I'm happy to start that one. Historically speaking, there's been a little bit of confusion around the sort of absolute or decision or the absolute definition of scenario planning. And that's because, at least since the 1990s, there wasn't academic consensus on what the term scenario itself meant. And that's something that Matt and I actually picked up as one of the first papers that we wrote together was trying to understand this problem about the confusion over the definition of scenarios in the scenario planning literature. And so what we did is we basically scoured the literature for every single example where scenario was defined. So these would be statements like scenarios are blank or a scenario is, and we basically amalgamated them all together and found that scenarios have six characteristics. The first one is, of course, is that they're temporally rooted in the future. And then secondarily, they almost always involve reference to some kind of a external force in that context, maybe a political force or an economic force. So there's a bunch of variability there, of course. From there, we found that scholars make the argument that any scenario should be obviously possible, but to some extent also very plausible, and that the appropriate form for them to take is a narrative, or to put it more plainly, a story, only it's set in the future, obviously not in the past. From there, we know that they exist in sets and that they're meant inside of those sets. This is the final criteria, to be meaningfully different from one another, so that there's not a lot of overlap in the scenarios. They're related, but they cover different ground. And so we've worked on what the word scenario means in there, although Matt is the one with experience actually conducting scenario planning in facilitated workshops. So maybe you want to take over the planning part for this one, Matt?
It's a bit of a kind of a mismarked nomer for the actual field that we work in, right? So planning assumes that you've got a budget and you've got a project and you're trying to implement that project. Where when you've got a set of scenarios sitting in front of you and you're trying to figure out what they mean, we're looking for a few different types of other types of outcomes rather than just plans for the future, right? So the first thing is that we're looking to ideate options. So if you think of the scenario as the puzzle, what's the solution to that puzzle? And the solution to these puzzles are often going to be come out in this world of, say, strategic options or ideas or actionable initiatives or something like that. But when you put that together again, the scenarios come back into the discussion again when you want to start talking about their ability to simulate the outcomes of those options. So imagine that you find some solutions to these types of puzzles, and as you think of them and how they would unfold under these conditions set forth by the scenarios, right? You're in this kind of, you're stress testing your ideas, right? You're trying to figure out what is the options that we have for ways forward. So we're not setting a plan, a particular singular plan into place, but we're looking for a divergence of different possibilities that we can move our organization into the future.
Okay. All right. So you're honestly the first group or individuals to break up the concept of scenario planning between the artifacts, right? The output that comes at the end pretty much, but then the process itself as well and what it can be. And yeah, I've cited that first paper. It is a pretty popular one. And in fact, I'll put up your decision tree that you mentioned, Nicholas, at the start, because it's actually one of the graphics figures I use to teach how to illustrate qualitative data to the PhDs and stuff, because decision trees are just really nice. They're really intuitive and understandable. So
I can't take credit for that. Matt thought of the flowchart idea.
I thought so, Matt. I thought so.
I use it in a course called concept analysis. So you can use that format, right? So the concept analysis or concept engineering also follows a similar type of method, if you will, right? So there are ways to do this kind of work independently of scenario planning, right? I wrote a paper on greenwashing with some students that we use a very similar type of method. And I find that PhDs actually get a ton of value out of something like that, because you're teaching them how to do what's called a scoping review, right? Which is like a miniature literature review for students. And so it's quite a really nice way to get inducted into the PhD world or the research field, right? By being able to work with the literature in a very abridged fashion before you go out and do, say, more systematized or large literature reviews. So, and it gets cited. The paper actually gets cited a lot as a way to do that, rather than for its value as kind of defining scenario in itself. So that's interesting you bring that up.
Wow. Well, there you go. I think it all fits well. And I just realized in this moment, I never told y'all that I use your decision tree as a regular teaching example. So let's see if we can find out about similar exciting unexpected insights with your new approach here. One thing I do recognize in your work, and there's a few out there in our field where you consistently keep, and when I say you, I mean the both of you, I'm trying not to be too Southern here, but y'all both together, really like, I don't want to, I'm trying to be not too flowery in this, but you really bring in new stuff. Okay, you bring in new concepts that maybe we've all been talking about a bit in the past, or we chat about between talks at conferences and stuff, but y'all are really one of the teams that gets there first and paves the way. So this chapter, I remember talking with each of y'all independently, and this idea just sort of came out, and I remember saying, what do you kind of just have sitting on the sidelines that you haven't found a platform yet to talk about? And that's where this conversation, at least with me, came up for the book. So I did some searching afterwards, and I repeatedly have done this for the last 2 years when we first discussed your chapter, which is about examining the emotional elements in the facilitation of scenario planning, right? So I just before this interview here, right? I did it again. I went and I did a broad search of scenario planning as it's represented both in the public sphere and in the academic scholarship, because these are very, very different representations sometimes. And maybe we rail against that a bit too much. I don't know. Maybe not enough. But what I find is they do align in some key concepts, right? So if you look for scenario planning in the private sector, you'll see terms like foresight and forecasting, uncertainty, risk, things like that come up. In the academics world, you'll hear those plus decision-making. In the private sector, you'll hear more about agility and adaptiveness. Sure. But what is almost exclusively missing, in fact, I didn't get any hits, to be honest, except for your publication, was the discussion of the concept of emotions, or as we say in social sciences, affect, right, in the scenario space. And I am just as interested as to why this is not being brought up more now as I was before, because foresight is rooted in the human agent. It's humans engaging in foresight thinking. It's humans engaging in scenario planning, and it's humans that are the facilitators. So we know that humans, we as the species, are almost exclusively motivated by our emotions. And so we need to bring that into the dialogue. So I would like to pass the ball back to you now. What got you started on this idea of looking at the emotional aspect of scenario planning?
Sure. I'm happy to start. Three things come to mind right away. One of them is that a couple years prior, we had been invited to a book about cognition. Now, the link then from cognition to emotion ended up happening in this paper because the way that emotion is, at least the most frequently, but I do agree that it's extremely rare, especially in any coherent way, despite the obviousness of emotion in the human drama that is every group level facilitation, planning practice, strategy, development, and so on and so forth, is in terms of hot and cold cognition. That's what that's the like the jargon from higher education.
So could
Hot
you walk us through
cognition,
that? Oh, sure.
no, happily. Hot cognition is talking about during a especially decision-making processes, times when basically emotions are running high. That's the hot part, and that it's seen as interrupting cognition. That is that it discourages rational thinking in part because the emotions take over. They're sort of unregulated emotion. And then there's this other thing called cold cognition. And you can imagine it's basically just the opposite, where you're being like, cold, very rational, and you're keeping things, keeping the emotion level low. And the belief in that line of research is basically that hot cognition is bad and it interrupts and inhibits rational decision making. And then there's cold cognition, which seems to facilitate it in some way. Now, Matt and I weren't super satisfied with that when we thought about our own experiences in this place, but that's how we got to emotion. It was through cognition. It was being asked to write a book chapter about cognition. And secondarily, though, as soon as I read between the lines that even though those two terms are all about cognition, they're also all about emotion too, since that's the major variable force that's in the background, right? And so being a very, I would say, a classically trained sociologist that, took a lot of theory courses and everything like that, sociology of emotions has emerged in the mid-1970s and has been regularly utilized in order to look at how emotions fit into social structure, how they were driven by shared norms, especially within organizations, and how they play a role in group level processes, of which the facilitation of scenario planning is, of course, a great example. So for me, that wasn't a leap at all, even though they didn't seem to be connected in my understanding of those literatures. But then the third part, this is the real part, this is the heart of it all. Is when I first started working again, remember how I told you, Matt and I kind of we went to college together, then had like a period of time where we did our own separate work and then came back together once Matt was earning his PhD. When I would listen to Matt, and he had a lot of scenario playing experience already, in between the lines all the time was language about emotional regulation, and that when that was the most interesting thing, if you ask me. Bring a scenario planner in front of you, they'll talk about emotion, no problem. Ask them to write about it, it doesn't exist. For some reason, it gets the very humanness of some of it just gets kind of taken out. And so honestly, I came to that conclusion in part just listening to Matt about when he was frustrated or when he had clients that were in a really negative emotional state and almost refused to play along and things like that. And so that's the truth behind it all, honestly. And so, since I brought that up, Matt, do you want to pick up on that one?
I think Nick was able to see that between the lines, and that's quite astute of him. I think a lot of times when scenario planners, consultants are called into organizations, you're really not faced with, a very bright, sunny day, right? Oftentimes they're
That's true.
struggling, and if they could solve the problems that they're facing, they would have solved them. But they're bringing in external help to do this often. And so there's some issues that are already kind of unraveling inside the organizations. Perhaps they've lost a client. Perhaps they've lost a major supplier and they're trying to build back their resilience, for example. But one of the main tasks that I see as the facilitator has is when you're walking into a situation in an organization in such a state, How is it that we can kind of make them do things differently, right? And so part of the emotional management stuff tries to shift them from the state that they're in to something where we can kind of jointly find new solutions together. And I'm a big proponent of the idea that that requires fun, right? So as an emotional state in itself, I believe that we're having fun when we're solving problems, when we're seeing new things, when we're collaborating with one another, when we're building on other people's ideas, when we're iterating. And so emotions can then work in our favor, right, when we can get that excitement going. And consultants and facilitators out there would recognize those moments that when you get that conversation and it's moving in the right direction and people are really kind of ping-ponging and doing a great job, our job as facilitators can be just to kind of hide over in the corner, not say anything, right? To get out of their way because they're finding ways and doing things and reigniting that conversation that they've had a hard time having, right, over time as they kind of slip in and move and say drift in the directions that they're going.
The two of you paint a pretty, I think, accurate picture of what a lot of us experience in the scenario consulting space, right? So we're entering a room where we are already recognized because they brought us in as the scenario planning expert. We're taking that consultant role, and often they're strangers, right? We might know one or two people in the room because that's who we've been setting up the intervention and the workshops with, but a lot of the other people, a lot of the other executives will be strangers, and they have this way that everybody comes with their expectations, in short, right? And those expectations, as you say, like when we talk about this, we imply a lot. Sometimes explicitly, we're saying, they're grumpy, or they're disruptive, or they're very friendly or shy, or and some of these are behaviors I'm largely mentioning, but they're rooted in these assumptions of emotions, right? And then our reactions to them, because it's our role. We constantly talk about going back to what we say versus what we publish, that Nicholas was mentioning, is we present ourselves though as these sort of objective people, right? Like the way when the doctor comes in, we assume the doctor is going to be objective. When the expert comes in, we assume they're going to have some sort of, rational, if you will, look. And I will push back maybe later on the difference between emotional and rational, but I really want to get to your work first. I really want to focus on that. So I do like this picture that you're painting here, and it's something I agree. We need to be more maybe forthcoming with acknowledging what these pieces are. And all of us have a social science background. I think maybe that's why some of us are more ready to recognize that than others. Like you say, Nicholas, you were the one who started seeing these between the lines things. Matt, you're the one who was speaking about these things to start with. So let's take that picture, right? You've got at least one facilitator in the room. You've got a whole bunch of people who generally know each other and have a completely expectation of working with each other, which we are about to disrupt as the facilitator in the room. Now, when it comes to we talk about group think, we talk about group dynamics. Well, here's a group emotions, right? How do you see these emotions, our emotions, influencing the decision-making process that is happening or hope to happen when we do these scenario planning workshops?
So I think that's a very interesting question, what you're asking here about how does it influence the decision making that goes on in the room? In those scenario planning workshops, it's not like they're taking critical, like organizational type of decisions either. I mean, they're simulating potential options through these different types of conditions and the scenarios. And I think so it's more of an exploratory than it is some kind of like closing down kind of part of the design diamond, if you will. But there's plenty of people that are coming in with loaded agendas, right? With something that they have to get done, with maybe a group of stakeholders inside the organizations that have their demands on the table, right? So there's a lot of pressure that we can't necessarily know all the intricacies of. And this is a challenge because these manifest themselves in all sorts of different ways, right? One being, the person that doesn't want to play along, right? And
And that
there's
can be
always
any
one.
role, right? That can be a C-suite member, that could be a CFO, CEO, or that could be
And
one of
that's
the
hard.
external members, right?
And it's a delicate moment and it's a fragile moment, right? And so trying to get them to back up and, downplay, if you will, a little bit of the seriousness of the episode to take them into this kind of hypothetical, these aren't real stakes we're talking about, right? These are just going through some of these, right, thought experiments and trying to move them away from this whole, we're gonna make a huge decision right now, right? That's gonna impact all you, your agenda, and all your stakeholders to something more, let's just explore, some of the different options that we have, right? And so that's a big moment, right? To get those people, if we call it the buy-in, right? To get the buy-in, to get the group moving forward together to be able to do this kind of thinking.
I big surprise. I agree with Matthew, having observed him facilitate numerous times. I think he's exactly right. And so maybe returning to that idea that emotion and rationality are somehow locked together in this hot and cold cognition modeling. I don't know that I've ever seen a facilitator actively try to bring the emotional state down in order to get to rationality. And in fact, when it's the most successful, I often find what's going on is they're creating what we might now call like a safe space or a space where you can have hypothetical thought experiments where nobody is 100% committed to any which direction. And like Matt said before, it's exploratory in nature. And then you get people into, for lack of a better phrase, a somewhat, I would call it like heightened engagement. Because I don't think it involves less emotion. I don't think it involves, I'm not trying to get, Goldilocks and the Three Bears here and say that it's either too little or too much, but you got to get it just right. But I think there is an emotional state that can be induced by creating an environment where people feel free to share and make guesses and maybe say something that isn't the brightest, as they're just kind of exploring the future, but they're engaged and they're fully willing to, I don't, for lack of a better word, play, right? They're
Well, that goes back
trying
to what
to,
Matt was saying.
yeah, that's exactly right. And so I don't think it's not cold cognition. I think it's something more like what Matt is saying about getting people engaged and giving them a enough room and enough emotional space so that they don't feel like if they make a mistake, they're going to be judged by their colleagues, or a situation where, unlike in regular business operations, maybe your boss brings up an idea and it hasn't been the greatest idea that he or she has ever heard, and you create some space to get out of the internal politics. This is probably the key. Get out of the internal politics that are blocking the ability of this organization to do this on their own. I think that's the emotional regulation piece that gets delivered when someone like Matt is facilitating.
There's another model that we'll often find also in the literature regarding Daniel Kahneman's thinking fast and slow, right? Where he's got the system one and system two thinking. And I think it's got some similarity what we're thinking about in the hot and cold cognition. But the hot and cold cognition is more about emotionally laden decisions again. And the thing where the thinking hot or the thinking fast and slow is about the time or the speed it takes you to make a decision. And I also think that this is also an unfair, say, depiction of what's going on in these workshops. I'll advocate for a Goldilocks, third way, that if we can switch this form that we communicate into a collaborative strategic conversation, right, where we're using creativity and all of, our imaginations and all of our puzzle-solving abilities, right, to apply to these types of, organizational questions, then it does become something that's really engaging, right? And we can really build and use each other's momentum. And so the positive side of this is it doesn't necessarily require that it's a hot or cold or a mode one or mode two when we can have that and we feel like we can find that. And some people will find that flow, right? But that's often depicted as an individual type of activity where you find that flow when you're in that in the zone kind of thinking. But we can also have that interpersonally, and we don't find that very much in the literature.
Sounds like a future paper. Definitely. Well, the let's see. So many thoughts. I do like the way you said, Matt, that one of the things you look for or is enjoyable or is aimed for in these strategic planning places, spaces, right? With the scenario teams, as a facilitator is it's like trying to not manufacture, trying to excite fun, right? Trying to get some funness at which then, as you, Nicholas, say, it becomes almost like a hot trying to think of the word and it got what left me hot cognition, right? Emotions start running high, but not necessarily in a bad way. And then, as you say, Matt, you just kind of get out of the way and just let them run. And I think we've all been there before where it's like, no, I don't want to disrupt this flow. And it puts me in mind of the old Model T cars where you had to like wind them up. And sometimes it took a while. And that first crank was always the hardest because the machine's the coldest and the way oil used to be back then and lubricants, it would be very thick and you really had to heat that up. But once it went, you would not touch it again. You wouldn't want to touch it again. You would disrupt what the machine's now self-perpetuating functioning was, so or flow was. So yeah,
Have to,
I like
right?
that.
And then we have to disrupt it because, somebody set a time plan,
Right,
right, for the
right.
day,
You gotta go.
and you have to go up there and say, "Oh, I'm really sorry that I have to interrupt such, interesting conversations, but now we have to move on."
So let's go with that. The speaking, saying the things that we don't really say in the professional spaces, like in our publications. I wonder, and this one thing that I've wondered since we first talked about this topic of emotions in the spaces and what it means for the client, what it means for scenario planning broadly, is I wonder how much of the facilitator has to like bring in this cult of personality. Almost because we talk about fighting against that sometimes when we have the decision makers in the room, like we say, the boss or the CEO or something who is creating this sort of blockage, right? But it's because they've cultivated this sort of like cultural, no, corporate culture, personality type, and then everybody's responding to them. And one of our colleagues, George Wright, he's talked about taking those people out of the room for a while so everybody else will talk. And I've wondered how much of this that we're talking about requires us to manufacture that within ourselves to this cult of personality. And they're like, no, trust me. We just got to get through the first windup. Right? We just got to get to the pitch. We just got to get to that. And then just letting them go and then keeping that momentum going. Because Matt, it's not just ending the workshop, right? It's saying, okay, now we got to think of, in a different way. And now we got to take what you did and think in a different way now, because we have like creativity at the start and then causality and puzzle solving in the middle, and then we get all the way to others. So I wonder how much of that is really facilitated by, yeah, embracing a very specific profile of emotional. I don't want to say manipulation, but sometimes it almost feels like that because we have to get through it. Back to you.
Pass.
Oh,
I don't know what to do with that, Megan. No, that's great. It's a
you're
great
welcome.
great observation. I don't know. Just cut this out. I don't know. I don't know. I'm sorry. That's a cult of personality. You got me stuck on that. That's where you got me stuck. And you probably got Nick stuck too on cult of personality because we were thinking maybe we could go to the difference between emotion work and emotional labor if we haven't been there. Have we been
Yeah.
there yet?
No, we haven't. We've just barely touched upon that. With that in mind, you have these divisions that you have touched upon, which is the difference between, and it links into what we were just talking about, but I really wonder, it links between emotional labor, right, and emotional work. And again, along with the broader conversation about emotions, not really discussed these, not only concepts in and of themselves, but the difference between them. So with this idea of cult personalities and getting people going and all that kind of stuff, how do you see these differences?
Interesting.
And especially in the context of a facilitator, particularly.
Right, right. I think these two terms get us some additional purchase in not only the way we think about it, but also the way we would examine this from a scientific perspective. So the first piece that you brought up, I'm actually going to go in reverse because I think that might be better to start with work. So when we talk about emotion work, and again, keep in mind, this is the mid-1970s in sociology when these ideas first emerged. Emotion work is not meant to be, even though the other one, labor and work, you almost think that like they must be synonymous because those words could, you know, stand in for one another. When scholars use the terminology of emotion work, they're simply referring to the effort that you or I or anyone else inside or outside of an organization would is asked to exert on a daily basis in order to manage and control their expression and presentation of emotion during human interaction. So all the time we are filtering what emotions we're going to allow to move into the exterior part of our person or ourself, and what emotions we're going to keep tight to the chest or keep a poker face, as they sometimes say, right? Now, all of us are doing that all the time, right? I mean, there are definitely moments I'm sure lots of people know these moments where inside you're really frustrated or really upset with somebody, but on the outside, nobody would know, right? So this is emotion work. And the reason they call it work is that's the effort that you have to deliver in order to do that. Emotional labor, though, this is now we're in the labor market. So we're talking about occupations, work inside of organizations, thing like that. And emotional labor then refers to the economic aspects where emotion is an explicit part of your job. That is, to deliver your labor effectively and in exchange for money, you need to manage the emotional states of others, and of course yourself. And in some lines of work, this is really obvious. You know, so in one of the banner examples in early sociology, there was the case of airline stewards and airline stewardesses, where when, for example, a plane experiences some turbulence, their job is to literally go into the cabin and manage people's emotional states so that they're calm and everything is collected, right? The truth is, loads of professions are asked to do emotional labor all the time, but you'd never find it in their job descriptions, right? Nobody's going to say that, for example, a contemporary job, since we're all faculty members, a contemporary aspect of the faculty workload right now is managing the emotional states of students. Sometimes that's in the classroom where you want to keep discussions productive, and so that they don't devolve. Other times, and I know scholars are talking about this more than ever right now, in, for example, office hours and outside of the classroom, where faculty members are being asked to act as kind of like de facto psychological counselors for their students and things like that. And so you'd never see that in a job description, but I think people are getting the sense that that is emerging as more of a norm. And so that's the distinction. Emotion work, we're all doing it all the time. It has a lot to do with how we keep some emotions in and let others out, sometimes selectively or even strategically. And then emotional labor is where your pay is effectively tied to either creating an emotional state in somebody else, like as a server, say at a restaurant, or as part of managing, say, your clients or your customers or something like that. But you brought up the idea of how does that work with a cult of personality? You know, when you've got a, let's say a big wig in the room while you're trying to get people into a more dynamic and imaginary space to deal with some of the thought experiments that you're really challenged with in the organization. And sometimes that gets clogged up, right? If the current strategy is being designed by someone who's elite in the organization, you're going to find out when they come up with ideas during brainstorming practices, they're often the best idea in the room. And the reason why, of course, is that there are political consequences even though you try to create for the best of your ability a safe space to be exploratory in these facilitating practices, there are realities. There are definitely members, there are employees and organizations that don't want to look dumb in front of their colleagues. They don't want to say something that might become, I don't know, used against them in the future. They might find that if they make too many recommendations that are unpopular, it might come up in their next round of employee review or something like that. And so, you know, I think it's undersold exactly how much at risk some employees put when we ask them to do some of this more exploratory work, especially in the context of their peers. And so I did my best to touch on the cult of personality thing. That's a hard one. That's a hard one because the truth is, because that is so rarely talked about in any systematic way, I feel like part of it is we don't even have the analytical vocabulary yet to fully parse out some of those issues. I don't disagree. I think that they're real. And I feel like I know what that is when I hear it in a more casual conversation, but getting at that empirically, that would be interesting. Really, really interesting.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what first got me thinking about that as even like a mover and shaker in the room, you know, of the scenario space is when I was learning from George, my supervisor, and he had his ways. I mean, he had been doing it for ages. So he was obviously teaching me through his methods, which involved his even just physical gestures, you know, just the way he walks around the room, all this kind of stuff, just everything about him. And I was absorbing it like a sponge, as you should, right? This is how it works. And you're the student and you're being mentored. And I really said none of it, no, not none of it, but a lot of what I thought would work for me, because I was just parroting him in these very effective ways, as is not a bad thing, but I was noticing they weren't working for me. And then I started, all right, I'm a researcher. I'm just going to systematically try and figure out, take notes and figure out which parts aren't working and why. And I mean, it's hard to pin down a lot of what I'm about to say, but my mitigations and alterations help support what I thought I was seeing, which is George is an older man in the room who commands authority. And I was a younger female in the room attempting to command authority. And even when I do, when I figured out how to bring that authority into the space, which goes back to something you were saying, Nicholas, about we got to get them to trust us first. We got to get them to trust the process. And then, you know, we go to what Matt was saying, which is then we can get them going. And then, you know, they start going, right? Just to get through that trust part, I had to create a whole other version of myself. It's not that it's inauthentic, but it definitely wasn't George. And it definitely wasn't who I was bringing in before. And that's why I started thinking like, okay, well, maybe this is like, I need them to sort of halo effect me a bit. And then I can just pass the ball back to them and get out of the way. Right. So that's what got me thinking about it. And that at its core is, yeah, a lot of emotional, not work, just work for me and labor, but like specifically trying to watch theirs and sort of facilitate their emotional spaces as well. Or at least that's how I was interpreting it. I don't know. We're breaking new ground here. These weren't part of our questions.
I think that that's great. I think that you're on the right. I think you're absolutely on the right track. And interestingly enough, despite the fact that you would think all of that should be a core part of the training process for getting people ready for the field, I mean, you just do not have an emotional management 101 sort of piece, even though, like Matt said before, I think it's really important that oftentimes the emotional state is already heightened when you show up, because if things were going well, you wouldn't need external support. Right. And then the expectation is not only that, well, they're coming in hot, is that you're going to be able to manage them. Right, that they're asking for some outside. That's literally the point of facilitation, right? And so the assumption that, you know, you're going to walk into a place with a heightened emotional state, and that you're going to be expected to manage it, and then simultaneously keep in mind with the emotional work piece, also personally manage your own emotional state too. So that even if, for example, you know, you've got, like you said before, like one of the big wigs in the room just like won't play ball or mm-hmm. whatever the case might be, instead of experiencing your authentic emotion, which could be deep levels of frustration, like, why did you bring me here if you're not going to play ball in the first place? Yeah. So that's where the emotional thing is really intense, because you're self-regulating your emotions while simultaneously managing the emotions in the room, all of which needs to move into a productive space. Or else things fall apart pretty quick.
Right. So that was some of what we were talking about before, where, yes, so there's these challenges, right? These challenges of as the facilitator of managing a bunch of cats that we're trying to herd in the room for their betterment. So let's step from there. I think we've talked about this quite a bit, but I'd like to hear what ethical concerns arise when facilitators manage or manipulate emotions in the workshop.
How does that go? How does that go, Nick?
Well, just the idea that people in other areas where the work is highly about emotional regulation talk about mm-hmm. burnout. So like the airline craft or the airline stewardesses, for example, mm-hmm. because they're so disassociated with their authentic emotional state on a daily basis, mm-hmm. they become slowly more and more estranged from their actual feelings. And this coming from the States, you're familiar with that restaurant named Hooters with that. Yeah.
Did but I guess that like right?
Sports oh bar God. Kind of place. I mean, it's like,
oh, it's a Hooters.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know what it's well, so they ran almost the same kind of interviews with women that were working at these places. And one thing that I will never forget was they were conducting one of the interviews right after a woman had gotten off like three, like long back to back to back, you know, where she was just like being, you know, low key sexually exploited in the workplace, basically, you know, like, can't wait to get you guys more beers so you can sexually harass me more. This should be great. And at the first question, she basically said something like, well, how are you today? How are you feeling? There's just kind of like a early rapport question. And her answer was, I don't know. I haven't been myself all week. And I was just like, God damn, you know, like that really hits, you know? And so either way, some emotional estrangement I think is there. So I can start with that.
Yeah, maybe, but I don't, as a facilitator, I can't say, I mean, I'm drained. Like energy wise, but I wouldn't say that I get into some kind of emotional, or do I? That's hard for me to feel. I don't know. Do you get there, Megan? Because
well,
I don't
that's,
know if I, you just said you did, right?
Yeah. It's, yeah. I mean, to an extent, exactly. And what Nicholas mentions is, I mean, not to make it, reduce it too much, too reductive, but like, welcome to the woman's world. I mean, I've had these conversations with my kids who are both boys, and I've told them jokingly, but it came from a very serious place. Just one day out of the blue, I said, wow, I don't know how much of my personality is me and how much of it is just a lifetime of coping mechanisms. Because
Jesus Christ, sorry.
Right? Well, that's wow. why I said it.
Wow.
And I think that gets back to what I was saying about, you know, as facilitators, how we command the space, how we lead the space, or how we feed into the space, or, you know, whatever approach we take. And clearly, George had one approach after a career of making, you know, this practice really famous, basically. And then myself, who was brand new, and not only from a different country, but a different, you know, selection of demographics on top of that. So, yeah, no, I think these are very real functions in the space that maybe we don't always bring out. So that does bring in this ethical sort of conversation, right?
Okay, you can go ahead and ask the question. I think that Nick can do a really good job here. I'm not sure that I can, maybe you guys go for it. If I can bring in this Peter Schwartz stuff, if I find a dovetail for it that makes sense, I'll go there. But it's not the facilitator's ethical problem. It's more of a contextual ethical problem than it is our problem, right? So Peter Schwartz says, in the extended version of the long view, right?
That was his book, The Long View.
Mm-hmm.
Take
You got to write over there.
Lessons from the Long View, that it came out in like 2010. Anyway, was kind of like an echo book that he wrote. He talks about an ex a facilitation session where he's got a gold mining company in the room, and the CEO's in there, and all of the top brass are in the room, and they're building out some of the scenarios. And but the CEO's had a very kind of dedicated, kind of strategic direction, right? And he's going to buy up other gold companies, and that's what he's going to hear to do. And in the scenarios, comes the question, what happens if the gold prices turn and go south, right? And that would kind of be a bad result of the strategic plan that the CEO. Anyway, after the session, the CEO was able to identify the people in the room who had different opinions about his, strategy direction, and he fired them. Right. And Peter Schwartz didn't know that this was going to happen. Right. But he did it anyway. Right. And then lo and behold, doesn't take much long after that. And then the prices of the gold go south. Right. And the CEO gets fired by the board. So, I mean, but the facilitator in the room, Peter's trying to create the safe space for the people to speak their minds and explore freely.
That's the
When
irony,
that,
though.
where it wasn't the case, right, that it was actually being used as a moment where the CEO could identify the people who might be against his strategy, right? So
See, but
that's kind of his,
that's a good
it's not
one
the
though,
facility.
because the facilitator is the one who's brought in and asked to create this safe space, but then and then it could be used for
Yeah.
purposes like that. I mean, that's an
It's like a
ethical issue.
tool.
But you got a lot of this, yeah, a lot of it's this value. The other way you could go with a question like this is this kind of value-free exploration where, look, we don't have dogs in the fight in a sense, right? So the scenarios are up on the wall and we try to treat them rationally, right? Whether or not we want them to happen is not kind of the point of the exercise. It's whether or not they can plausibly happen and what should we do if that's the case, right? And that's a different discussion, right? Where Vanderheiden very much is in the movement of we should create value-free scenarios, right? Where we don't necessarily take ethical positions on them. But then you've got things like Popper coming in from the back door saying, look, if the solutions to those puzzles or those scenarios are ethically challenged, then that's justification for the refutation of that, right? So there's a moral in context moment of ethical types of, say, reasons to get rid of maybe the unethical strategic options, right, in the moment, rather than judge the scenarios, you judge the options, right?
And
And I don't know if you want to go there with the question, right? Because it's the question you can go in a number of different ways. You know what I mean? When you bring ethics in.
In your experience, what are people right now, what are people not talking about that you think they should be talking about?
Well, I'll take the first swing at this one, and it loosely relates back to our paper, but not exactly. I would say that probably one of the most important trends that's being discussed both publicly and in scholarship for strategic foresight and scenario planning and the entire future-oriented planning area is the rise of AI and specifically what that means for facilitators. If you want to talk about something that stirs some strong emotions amongst facilitators, it's whether or not their jobs could be replaced by AI. And one of the themes that I seem to sense in this area is that a lot of scholars, and it turns out ourselves included in some of our earliest work on this topic, engaged with different AI tools. And the underlying current was more or less some version of, well, these machines will never be able to do what we are going to do. And there was a kind of low-key celebration of human exceptionalism in those conversations. But I think a lot of that needs to be returned to, and we need to think a lot more deeply about what can be done with AI and where and when, and really have a much more structured and strategic conversation. Which I say obviously without irony. That said, in all of the discussion about AI as it pertains to strategy and planning, just like the broader discussions, Megan, that you brought up before, also almost exclusively missing from those discussions is any role of emotion and affect. And to be clear, Matt and I have been writing about AI. Matt and I have been writing about emotion and scenario planning. And I don't know that even we ourselves noted that part of our reaction to the rise of AI is starting to think through some of these emotional regulation pieces in facilitation that that I'm not sure how AI figures into just yet. But that's where I think we should be going, is trying to understand that piece for facilitators, for scenario planning related to AI and emotion. I think there's some real work to be done there.
Okay. And to you, Matt, what do you think?
I think Nick said it the best.
Okay,
So thanks for having me on your
well,
podcast.
I
Not going to take a
agree.
swing, man?
No. Oh, no.
I mean, that's some
I don't know.
heavy-hitting stuff. That's the
That was
question,
great. I think
right?
Nick did a great job there. I don't think I want to add anything to that.
Okay.
Well, sorry if I stole your thunder.
I
No,
look
no, no.
forward to
No
your
thunder.
paper.
No thunder stolen. Everything else is, I mean, it's the question is, what do we should be talking about? And there's lots of little things that are coming in the pipeline, but stay tuned.
Right. Okay. We will. Everybody stay tuned. It was great having both of y'all here today. I'm glad we could get through a bunch of the topics we had floated around ideas about before, but just never had the time to really just have a chat about them. So that's great. Hopefully our audience laughed and cringed as much as we did. And yeah, I will see you at the next conference. So thank you very much.
You know, I
Excellent.
teach
Thank you.
cringe. I teach cringe. I have a lecture on cringe and why we should be looking for it. Right? Very good. Thanks, Megan.
Amazing.
Scenarios for Tomorrow is produced by me, Megan Crawford, with invaluable feedback from Dr. Isabel Ariza, Jeremy Creep, Brian Ego, and as always, my kids.
This is a production of the Futures and Analytics Research Hub and FAR Lab, affiliated with Edinburgh Napier Business School. You can find show notes, references, and transcripts at scenarios.farhub.org. That's scenarios.farhub.org. You can follow us across social media by searching for Scenario Futures, all one word. You can subscribe to Scenarios for Tomorrow wherever you listen to your podcasts. Today's track was composed by Rocket, whose links are provided in the show notes. This is Scenarios for Tomorrow, where tomorrow's headlines start as today's thought experiments.